Good morning. It's 9 minutes after 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and I'm Gene Purcell, here today filling in for Joy Cardine. Bill Emmett is our guest this hour. He is the former editor-in-chief of The Economist magazine and the author of several other books, including The Sun Also Sets. He's written a new book that examines the relationships between Japan, China, and India, and that will be the focus of this hour. The book takes a look at how those relationships will affect the rest of the world. The book is titled Rivals: How the Power Struggle Between China, India, and Japan Will Shape Our Next Decade. It's a look at the complicated relationships between those three places and how changes already taking place there will literally change the world. We'd like to hear from you, too. We've heard a lot about China and India, particularly lately, in terms of their growing economies. Japan may not seem like the economic power that it once was, but it is still a force to be reckoned with. What happens when you put all three of those together? Call in with your questions, your comments at 800-642-1234. If you're calling from the Madison area, it is 263-1890. And you can also join us by email. That address is talk@wpr.org. Bill Emmett joins us this morning, and according to my producer's note here, he joins us from Somerset, England, in the English countryside. Bill Emmett, good morning.
Good morning. It's very good to be with you.
It's good to have you along as well. We appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. I want to talk about the background of the book to start with, because it seems to me, with your background, with all the things that you've written about over the years, you could have written about many, many things. And why did you sit down and decide to write about the relationship between China, India, and Japan?
Well, that's nice of you to say that about my background. One part of my background is that I spent time in Japan in the 1980s. I lived there as a correspondent for The Economist, and I also wrote books about Japan. So I watched, you know, pretty much as an eyewitness, as Japan soared to global prominence and as it became a big issue in American politics, indeed global politics, because of worry about whether it was going to take over the world in some way. It was being so successful. Then I saw Japan go into a stagnation and a period of difficulty in the 1990s, and alongside it, China start to emerge as a real force to be reckoned with, and now as a source of, well, I suppose what Donald Rumsfeld would call shock and awe in world politics and the world economy. So I was watching very much as this change took place, but also conscious that the historical relationship and the local political relationship between Japan and China is really quite difficult. And indeed, there's been tension in recent years with hooliganism and riots in China in protest against Japan, sometimes at sporting events, sometimes otherwise. And this made me think, how is this going to work? Mm-hmm. How is it really that you're going to have these two countries that have been facing off against each other for hundreds, perhaps thousands of years, being strong alongside one another? And then as I looked at it, I came to realize there was actually another complication, which is the country that's the neighbor to China, the other side of China, the other side of the Himalaya Mountains, and that's India. India and China fought a border war in 1962, so in quite recent memory, just 40 years ago. And now India, some way behind China, but India is emerging also as a fast-growing economy with interests across the whole of Asia. So I started to think, wow, what will Asia look like when you've got three powerful countries all in that same region for the first time in history? How will they relate to one another? Is there indeed some possibility of conflict between them? We tend to think of the rise of Asia as being somehow a reflection on us in the West and a shift of power from us to there. We look at possible sources of tension and conflict between us and the East and Asia. But I thought to myself, maybe that's the wrong place to look. Maybe the place to look is inside Asia and the sources of conflict between the Asian countries.
And before you know it, you had a book.
And, well, it took a while.
Sure. Well, you know, I have to say that I guess I'm sort of guilty as charged in looking at those countries in a very separate sort of thing, because I would hear a news story about China, and I would think about China, or I would hear something about, and I remember, you know, when Japan was really something back in the 80s and early 90s, and I remember thinking it was all very singular and very isolated, you know, and I did tend to look at one all by themselves. And when you first started examining this more closely, how did that change your thinking?
Well, I think that, you know, these are very big countries, and looking at them individually makes a lot of sense. They are, you know, big populations, individual countries. But then I began to realize that what they were was individual big countries, increasingly with interests that span huge geographies. They're reaching across the whole region, like China going into Africa, wanting to get all those resources, build contracts with African countries to build new mines and oil fields. India starting to do the same. This meaning that the Chinese Navy was going to be sailing across the Indian Ocean for the first time, trying to protect those shipping lanes that it's building up from Africa, with movements going in the opposite direction. And I thought, well, these are countries that are very interesting in their own right, but also they're countries that are relating to one another more and more. And while we do need to understand them individually, we also need to work out how they're going to fit together. Just as we might look at France and Germany and Russia and Britain separately in order to know deep things about their cultures and society, but we also need to know how they're going to relate to one another. How's the European system going to work with these countries so close to one another? Maybe if we'd been looking in 1900 at this, we might have had a better understanding of the way in which these countries might produce a conflict that, of course, led to the First World War. So the same sort of thinking can now be helpful in Asia. Let's avoid the Third World War happening in Asia.
We're talking with Bill Emmett this hour. He is the author of the new book, Rivals, How the Power Struggle Between China, India, and Japan Will Shape Our Next Decade. If you'd like to join in, we've got an open phone line for you at 800-642-1234. You can also call our Madison number if you're calling from the Madison area at 263-1890. And email always works at talk@WPR.org. Bill Emmett, one of the things you talk about is the need for these countries at some level to work together, but at the same time, the title of your book is Rivals, and there's a real sort of dichotomy there where they got to work together, but there is a lot of tension there, and a lot of this tension is not exactly something that's happened in the last year or two. It goes back hundreds of years.
It does go back deep into history, particularly between Japan and China.
Yeah.
I have a quote in my book which comes from a man who was until recently Japan's foreign minister and who is tipped as a possible future prime minister of Japan. I asked this man, Mr. Aso, Taro Aso, what should I make of the tension between Japan and China? And his response was interesting. He said, I don't know why you are so surprised that there's tension today. He said, what you should understand is that we're two countries who have essentially hated each other for 1,000 years. There's no reason why it should be any different now. And while that was a slightly jocular sort of way of putting it, there's a lot of truth to that.
Mm-hmm.
These two countries have very related civilizations, and yet they've always seen each other as natural threats to one another, natural rivals. And I think particularly with a communist authoritarian government in China and a democratic one in Japan, that mutual suspicion is still there. I mean, it's not unusual for countries that are neighbors to be rivals. Britain and France fought wars through many centuries. Fortunately, we're not now going to do it again because we're both democracies. We both are within the European Union. We know that there's no point in doing that anymore. But I think between countries that have such different political systems, you can't be that sure.
Yeah, different political systems, and then in the more recent history, in the 20th century, of course, that the rivalry was unbelievably intense, and those memories still linger.
Oh, they do. in China, in particular, the bitterness of, mm-hmm. of memories about Japanese occupation, which really stretched from 1931 until 1945, wars being fought right across China through the 1930s, terrible atrocities taking place, like at Nanking, which the Chinese-American writer Iris Chang wrote an excellent book about a decade ago called The Rape of Nanking. All this is etched very hard on the Chinese memory. And the Communist Party has, to some extent, exploited this by emphasizing it in education textbooks, by using it for propaganda purposes. Understandably, since it's true that this took place, but also in a way that is not, it means that it's not going to disappear easily. It's not just simply a question of waiting for the next generation to come along who have less strong memories of this, because the new generation, the school children, are being taught to hate the Japanese.
Bill Emmett is our guest this hour. He is the author of the new book, Rivals, How the Power Struggle Between China, India, and Japan Will Shape Our Next Decade. We'd like you to join in if you can. 800-642-1234. What do you know about that part of the world? What are your perceptions about those economies? How will their working together change what happens here in the U.S.? If you're calling from the Madison area, it is 263-1890, and you can always join us on email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 21 minutes past 8 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 9, Kathleen Dunn and her guests preview the Kentucky and Oregon primaries, review the current delegate and superdelegate counts, and discuss recent political endorsements. A look at the Democratic primary coming up after 9 with Kathleen Dunn. For this hour, we continue our discussion of the new book by Bill Emmett called Rivals, How the Power Struggle Between China, India, and Japan Will Shape Our Next Decade. And Bill Emmett, by the way, for those of you who are listening, joins us from Somerset, England, and it's good to have him along. If you'd like to call in and join the conversation, 800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. And if you'd like, you can also use email. It is talk@WPR.org. And Bill Emmett, in your book, you take a look at each of these countries in turn, and that's at least how the book is structured. And I want to start with China, because that's the one that's sort of, it's first in your book for one thing, but it's also the country that people are talking about for a whole host of reasons these days. What are some of the things we should be thinking about when we think about China these days? There's the growing economy, of course, but there's a lot more to it than that.
Well, of course, I think that the immediate thing we should be thinking about is the terrible earthquake that's taken mm-hmm. place there last week. At least 75,000 people dead or missing, probably, as often happens in these eventualities, in these terrible things, the number will go up because more people will be found, more bodies will be found under the rubble. It's a terrible tragedy for China. What it tells us about China, I think, is two things. One, of course, it reminds us that it's a poor country, that for all the concentration that we have on the trade deficit with China, on Chinese companies entering new markets and all of that, this is a very poor country still, with an income per head, less than a 40th, or less than a 30th, rather, of that of the United States, and with buildings that are really not constructed to an adequate standard, as we've seen in the aftermath of this earthquake. Earthquakes kill people. We know that. They're terrible things. There was an earthquake in Japan a few years ago which killed 6,000 people in Kobe. So it can happen even in a rich, developed country, but in a poor one, then a lot of people die. So I think that's the first thing. It reminds us how poor China is. But also, I think we tend to think of China as being a monolithic country run by an authoritarian communist government which controls the country stamps out dissent and stamps on human rights. And while there's some truth to that, what this earthquake, I think, should remind us is that actually this is a very large country in which a lot of government is really done at a local level, at the Chinese equivalent, not just of states, but also of counties. and cities. And the real issue after this earthquake is going to be whether or not these local officials really were rigorous enough in enforcing building standards, in preventing corruption, in making sure that schools and hospitals in particular were being built to the right standard. This tension between local and central government, between local officials and the people around them, is one of the big problems of China, and a big problem for the central government of China. The first phase after a terrible earthquake like this is, of course, melancholy and sadness at the tragedy that's taken place. The second phase typically is going to be questioning as to why did this happen and why did so many people die. And I think in that, the target very much is going to be on those local officials in China. And then there'll be a question of what can the central government do about it? How can they react? How can they avoid being blamed? So that's one of the big things I think we need to bear in mind about China. Poverty, but also it isn't a country that's closely controlled by the central government, because it can't be. It's huge.
Yeah, and we saw other elements. We're talking about the earthquake specifically, but there was that, I think it was like a huge snowstorm or something several months ago when many Chinese workers go on holiday, and everything just fell apart. And it was very similar in that regard, and much criticism then of the central government and how it was handled.
That's absolutely right. And on the other hand, what we see with this latest earthquake is a rush by the Communist Party leaders from Beijing, the Prime Minister, the Premier Wen Jiabao, the President Hu Jintao, to get to the earthquake site, to be seen on television, to show the people that they are caring, that they're trying to do something about it. You'd almost think they were elected. You'd almost think that this was a democracy. So conscious are they of the danger of public opinion turning against them. And I think that that tells you something also about how in the modern televisual interconnected technological age, even Communist Party officials are having to behave in a different way. They are conscious of public opinion in a similar way to the way in which officials, politicians in a democratic country have to be, because they can't control public opinion.
And so when we think of China, we have to keep that poverty in mind. But it's also interesting that when I think of China, and I think a lot of people are like me, intellectually, I think we realize that poverty is there. But when you read the news accounts, all you do see is that sort of huge economic force coming at you.
That's right. And it is an impressive force. If you go particularly to the big cities of Shanghai and Beijing and a few others, what you see is new skyscrapers. You mm-hmm. see new roads. You see new companies. You read of and even maybe see companies producing products at half or two-thirds of the price that they're produced at in the West, and you think of this as a great economic force. If you go to the outskirts of Beijing, you start seeing shanty towns of migrant workers, who are all the workers working in the construction sites and so forth, desperately trying to find ways to get their families through school, trying to set up their own health system because the central government isn't providing it properly. You start to see even in the cities, the two sides of China, the very poor alongside the new gleaming China.
We talked a bit about Japan at the beginning of the hour. In your book, you describe it as powerful, vulnerable, and aging in the title of your chapter, and you spent a lot of time talking about the demographics of Japan.
Yes, that's right. You know, in the 1970s and 80s, when Japan was so much in the headlines, Japan had a population structure which was an advantage to it. It had more younger people as a proportion of the population than many countries did in the West. That helped to lower its costs. But because these young people were very much in a huge baby boom generation, even bigger as a proportion of the population than was the case in the baby boomers of the U.S. or of Western Europe, they are now suddenly shifting from being a relatively young population to being a relatively old population. The birth rate has collapsed in Japan, particularly because people aren't getting married as much as they used to, And as a result of that, the population is actually beginning to fall in number. America's population is rising quite strongly because of a mixture of higher and rising birth rates and immigration. In Japan, they don't like immigration. Immigration is culturally frowned upon. There's hardly any takes place. And the birth rate has fallen. So Japan has this problem of aging and shrinking population, which is raising labor costs and also putting a big burden on Social Security accounts and health spending.
And as we turn to India, the title there is Multitudes, Muddle, and Momentum. And one of the things that struck me in that chapter was the focus on education, because there is this perception here, I think, in the U.S. anyway, that the Indian population is very highly educated, very technical, very English-speaking, and ready to do all of our jobs. But And your book makes it clear that there is a lot of education there, but not nearly the amount that we might think.
That's right. You know, it's true that there are lots of well-educated technicians and engineers because there are a lot of Indians. You know, it's a population mm-hmm. of 1 billion people. Mm-hmm. But what happened really during the socialist period of India in the 40s, 50s, and 60s was that they concentrated their money, strangely, on universities, and particularly the best technical institutes, educating a tiny number of people very, very well, and neglected mass education. So the literacy rate in India, even after more than 50 years of independence from the colonial power of Britain, the literacy rate in India is only 70% of the population can read and write, whereas in China it's around 95-98%, depending on whose figures you believe. Basic education has been got much better in China, whereas in India, the university education for the tiny number of specialists is excellent, but the population for the mass of people is inadequate.
Yeah, that was kind of an eye-opener for me, I have to say. Let's move on now. We've got we'll get back and we'll start tying all these countries together in a bit, but we do want to take some time out for listener comments. And Dan joins us from White Lake. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. I'm wondering if your guest has read Kevin Phillips' book called Bad Money, and would he be inclined to throw Russia into this mix as ganging up, and plus Iran, ganging up on the United States, to devalue the dollar, does this cooperation stem somewhat from the fact that what the U.S. and the U.K. have done together by being mired down in Iraq is proved to the rest of the world that war is stupid, unproductive, uneconomical, and not the way to dominate the world. The way to dominate the world is depress the dollar and dominate the United States, and if they have to gang up on us to do it together, that's a far better way to succeed than war. And I'll listen off the air.
Dan, thanks for the call. And Bill Emmett, not exactly the topic of your book, but where does, Russia doesn't come up in your book, certainly, but there is great talk of, the dollar and the economy and so on. And what about Dan's point? I mean, is this something else that we need to be thinking about in the context of what we're discussing this hour?
Well, I thought Dan's point was interesting, and I'm very delighted to discuss any political or economic topic
okay.
with your listeners. I think that really the people who are ganging up to devalue the dollar are the government of the United States. That's the first point to make. I think that the dollar probably remained very valuable and powerful for longer than was in the interest of the United States itself. You ran up this huge deficit on the current account of your balance of payments of more than 6% of the economy, really big by any standards, and that needed the dollar to fall in order to price your producers back into markets. Your producers have become uncompetitive, and that has been facilitated by the cutting of interest rates by the Federal Reserve, which makes it less advantageous to hold dollars. So I would say that the real people trying to devalue the dollar are actually the government of the United States. And they're probably right, too. The one strong point in the American economy right now is exports, which are rising really rather fast, thanks to the cheaper dollar. But coming on to Russia and Iran and the war in Iraq and all of that, I mean, first point I'd make is, yes, I agree that military power is something to be used very, very sparingly, and most people, I think, in the world conclude that wars aren't a good idea and are not things that are economically advantageous at all. Secondly, Russia, I think Russia really is a story of oil price at $120 a barrel. You know, Russia is an economy like Saudi Arabia that booms when the oil price is high, that goes into collapse when the oil price is low. If the oil were not at $120 a barrel, we would not be worrying much about Russia, and Russia would not feel powerful. The fact is, though, that oil is $120 a barrel. I hope that won't last very long. I hope that it's going to fall. But as long as it stays high, we'll be worrying about Russia. They will then be able to do things that might tweak the tail of the American tiger, make them able to do deals with Iran, and knowing that America's not in a strong position to prevent it, that kind of reaction is going to take place. I don't think that they're ganging up with China and India, however. I think that both China and India, because they are consumers of oil, realize that they share an interest in getting that oil price down and not ganging up in any way on the United States. So I think it's not quite the picture that Dan puts it, but I think his point about the strength of Russia and the potential Russian relationship with Iran is well made.
Renee joins us now from Madison. Good morning, Renee.
Good morning. I was wondering if your guest could briefly comment, as we're discussing oil, if you could comment on how those three countries in Asia, how the frenzy for the quest for crude is going to impact those three growing economies in Asia in the next decade or two. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Renee, thanks for the question. And Bill Emmett, I think that's a pretty big one these days.
Absolutely. I think that's a good question from Renee. I think that really what's happening is that fortunately, China in particular, many other Asian countries as well, have a lot of capital. That's fortunate, I say, because what we need above all as a world is for more investment to be made in oil fields. We need people to be drilling wherever they can explore for oil and developing new fields. And fortunately, China needs oil, and it's got capital, and therefore it's throwing huge amounts of money into trying to develop new oil fields, particularly in Africa, where it can do deals with governments to get access, to get drilling rights, and to some degree in Latin America and in Asia as well. So I think that what we're seeing is a quest for resources, fortunately combined with capital, such that the result of this will be, over a period of the next 5 to 10 years, a big expansion in the number of oil fields that that are producing in the world outside the OPEC, the oil producers cartel. And that will be good because it will mean that we have more alternative sources of supply, we'll be less dependent on Middle East oil, and we will have coming onto the world market a lot of extra supply. Some people worry that this is all going to be just taken up by China and India, and there won't be anything for us. But I think in a market situation, they're not going to separate themselves from the world market, but also if they buy everything from their own fields in Africa, then that means that leaves more of the rest for us. So it still has an effect on the market. So I think it's a good thing that this is happening.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bill Emmett is our guest this hour. He is the author of the book Rivals, How the Power Struggle Between China, India, and Japan Will Shape Our Next Decade. And we've been talking about those three countries, how they are tied together in many, many ways, and yet they are still separate in many ways as well. We'll be continuing our discussion in just a moment. If you'd like to join in, you can do so at 800-642-1234. In Madison, it is 263-1890. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm filling in for Joy Cardine this week here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 20 minutes before 9 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After 9, Kathleen Dunn and her guests preview the Kentucky and Oregon Democratic primaries, review the current delegate and superdelegate counts, and then talk about some of the recent political endorsements and what that might mean in that Democratic primary. That's up after 9 here on the Ideas Network. For the rest of this hour, we're talking with Bill Emmett, a writer, speaker, and consultant on global affairs, particularly Asia. He is the former editor-in-chief of The Economist, the author of many books, and including the one we're talking about this hour, titled Rivals, How the Power Struggle Between China, India, and Japan Will Shape Our Next Decade. We're going to get right back into calls right now. You can join us, by the way, at 800-642-1234. If you're calling from Madison, it is 263-1890. Let's head to Economowoc right now, and Dick is with us. Hi, Dick.
Yes, good morning. A huge thank you to your author and guest. It's a tremendously important subject he has written on. A quick tourist observation and then another one. There's a hotel in Xi'an, China. That's the city with the terracotta army, where the lobby honors intensely friendship between Japan and China. My little tourist observation is that that seems like a pretty lonely honoring of friendship between two countries that really suffered terribly. China certainly suffered terribly from Japan's invasion around the years of World War II. As to the U.S., certainly what our own foreign policy has us desperately in bad shape. All three of these countries, whatever is going on between them, are out there cutting, doing nothing but cutting deals, making friends. We're very, very much behind the eight ball. Thanks again. Bye.
Dick, thanks for the call. And Bill Emmett, what about Dick's observation? Well, first, the little tourist observation that that plaque in on that hotel wall seemed awfully lonely.
Well, I agree with Dick. I've been around China quite a lot, and you see more museums and other things looking at the bad side of China-Japan relations than you do seeing the good side, if you like. I went to a museum about, I suppose, 30 or 40 miles outside Beijing, which is celebrated or marked the place where the Japan-China War began in earnest in 1937. And almost the whole of the museum is dedicated to really how terrible the experiences were for the Chinese during the 1930s in fighting with Japan, and how they've been really fighting with Japan ever since the 1890s, as the museum saw it. And then just at the end of the exhibition, there was a lonely little wall just with a few positive things about Japan-China relations today, flows of aid from Japan to China, the trade flows, the investment, and so on. And I asked myself, you know, what would school children, and of course the museum was mainly being visited by school children rather than people like me, what would school children make of this? They have a whole museum devoted to hostility and bad memories, and then just a tiny bit at the end which says some things are better today. It's a difficult balance to make at any rate. I hope that in future governments in China will see that they should be trying to emphasize more of the good side as well, just as the relations between France and Germany really are now characterized by a mixture of course, bad memories, but also a sense of a positive opportunity for cooperation in the future. I don't think we've quite turned that corner yet.
Let's move on and take another call right now. John joins us, and John is in Madison. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I think the Chinese have quite a righteous anger towards the Japanese. The Japanese have not acknowledged their true war guilt for the atrocities that were committed during that war that extended not for 5 years, but really from 1932 through 1945. And it goes way beyond just the issue of comfort women or the rape of Nanking. The Japanese had the same attitude towards the Chinese that the Germans did towards the Slavs. They were expendable. And it's been estimated between 13 and 19 million Chinese were killed during that war. And there were horrendous things going on, such as Shiro Ishii and his his biological experimentation archipelago from Peng Fan on around. There were about six or seven of these, and they did engage in biologic warfare against the Chinese. They killed roughly 300,000 of them by dropping bubonic plague and things like this, and the Japanese will continue to write things like this out of their school books. And they will go and publicly go to memorials acknowledging their pride in their fallen Japanese warriors. And this antagonism, will go on until the Japanese can really sit down, just like the German people have, and acknowledge their war guilt. But my question for you is that they have a one-child policy, and I read that this had resulted in 400,000 less Chinese. And I have never heard, to what extent do they conduct mandatory abortions?
Well, just to, if I may respond,
yeah.
First of all, briefly on the first question, on the first point made, which is a good point about Japan's failure to do what Germany has done and really face up to its war guilt, that really, a lot of the problem with that is that Japan has apologized many, many times and made huge reparations for its war guilt, but it hasn't really directly faced up to some of the atrocities that were done. And I think as a result of that, it tends to undermine its own apologies. And one reason for that is basically something that comes back to us, in other words, Britain and the United States, and what we did immediately after the Second World War with the war crimes trial in Tokyo in 1947-48, because we did two things. We covered up deliberately some of the atrocities, particularly the biological warfare, which was excluded from the war crimes trial by the Allies, because we did a deal in which we took the scientific findings, and basically the news of these and knowledge of these was not confirmed until 1980 as a result of this. Because we covered them up, and that then it was responsible really for Japan not facing up to those. Secondly, what we did was that in that war crimes trial, we basically condemned the Japanese not for the atrocities, but for just simply using war as an instrument of national policy, which of course is what we had done all the time in previous centuries and decades, and what we've done since. So we were hypocritical, I think, with the war crimes trial of 1947-48. And we directed ourselves at the wrong target. We should have been trying them for the atrocities. Had we done so, I think the history since then could have been a bit different. That's not to absolve them of their responsibility. Absolutely not. But I think it's partly the Allied responsibility as well. As far as mandatory abortions are concerned, that is not, to my understanding, a common practice in China. Of course, abortion does take place. It's not a society in which there is any religious opposition to abortion. But basically, the one-child policy is enforced principally through heavy fines, through fear, and those sorts of methods, rather than through mandatory abortion. The big consequence of the one-child policy is an imbalance between men and women, between boys and girls, because Chinese people practice both abortion and infanticide in order to achieve their preferred outcome of having a male heir. When you've only got one child, that's what you tend to go for. And I think that's the most dangerous and sad aspect of this policy.
You notice the questions that we've been getting concern almost exclusively so far China and Japan. And, we've been having this discussion for the last half hour or so, and India has almost been totally left out of the picture, yet it is, roughly about a third of your book. We talked a little bit about some of the issues facing India, but what does India bring to the table in terms of being a powerful force to be reckoned with as we look at these three countries and the future of what Asia is going to look like?
I think the reason, it's an interesting point you make, I think the reason there's less concentration on India is that it's not a communist country. It's not holding the Olympics this year. It's got a democracy, so it seems not so controversial, really. We don't feel that India is somehow an incomprehensible force bearing down on us. But also, it's poorer. Its California is only one-third the size of China. And so I think that we haven't yet really become fully aware of what India might do. You know, there's a little flurry about outsourcing of IT jobs mm-hmm. and so forth during the 2004 election campaign. But really, that's a tiny, tiny economic thing. I think what's going to happen with India is that it is going to become the manufacturing superpower of Asia on the heels of China. China is going to move out of the sort of cheap, low-end manufacturing as its economy develops and as its currency gets more expensive, devaluing the dollar, as your earlier caller put it, while India is really low-cost and India is really coming into its own as far as manufacturing is concerned. So I think in the future we're going to pay more attention to India because it's going to be a place producing cars, producing low-cost goods of all kinds, some of which we like, some of which we don't like.
And so, in fact, they're already doing some of that. Didn't an Indian company just buy a Jaguar and a Land Rover? Or no?
That's right.
Yeah.
And the same Indian company has announced, and indeed is just beginning to produce, the world's cheapest car coming off the production lines at $2,500 per car, which is an amazingly cheap price for a new car, which shows how competitive they're becoming. So I think India is going to be a force to be reckoned with in economic terms. In political terms, it's going to be friendly to us, however. It's not always going to do what we like, but nevertheless, it's basically friendly because it needs us. It's worried about China. It needs close relationship with the United States, which both Presidents Clinton and Bush have tried to forge, and it's a democracy, and therefore I think it feels more on our side than on China's side. That's the main point.
So manufacturing moves to India. What happens to fill that gap in China then as that manufacturing leaves?
Well, they will be moving up to more high-tech goods. You know, Japan went through the same evolution. It was really the place producing ultra-low-cost stuff in the 1950s and 60s. Then its environment got dirtier and dirtier. And then it had to have a big currency revaluation, and what it did was suddenly push itself up market from, if you like, the era of the steel mill and the chemical plant to an era of microchips in the 1970s and 1980s. And I think China's going to try to do the same. China's going to try to move sharply up market into higher tech goods.
And then where does that leave Japan?
Well, it means Japan's got to move even further up market.
Mm-hmm.
Japan is the one that's going to feel the heat from that because it's got great technology, but it's not been being as innovative in recent years as it needs to for its own good. And I think Japanese companies are going to start feeling the hot breath of Chinese competitors right down their necks.
And we've talked about some of the demographic shifts in Japan and how is that going to come to play? Because now it seems to me would be the time when you need people and you need innovation and all of those things. And it seems to me that they're in a tough spot.
They are in a tough spot. They're going to have to invest more and more in knowledge, in capital-intensive production, in production that doesn't need so many people. Both of services and of goods, and they really need to emphasize innovation, technology, education, and to move more and more into efficient services, which they can do, but they've had a rather overprotected service sector, too little competition going on there, and what they need is like a Ronald Reagan to come in and shake up and deregulate and shake up more of the Japanese economy during the next 10 years.
And the one question I can sense listeners thinking as they're sitting at home or in their car listening is, where does that leave the U.S.?
I think that it leaves the U.S. In a position where it should be aware that you're going to get a continued rise of these countries in Asia that are going to compete economically with American companies. But because there are three of them, this is not so much a political threat to the U.S. as it might have been, because the U.S. can play a balance of power politics. It can play a divide and rule politics, playing off Japan and India as allies against China as the potential adversary for the U.S. And so I think that's a good outlook for the U.S. Challenging economically, challenging it in technology, in keeping its own recovering from the current subprime crisis. But politically, I think this is actually a good situation for the U.S., because even as these countries get bigger, I think the U.S. is going to remain the single most important country in the world.
We've got time for one more call, and we will take it from Derek, who is with us in Round Lake. Good morning, Derek.
Yes, hi, good morning. Good show. I have a question to the esteemed guest about the quality of portrayal of the developing world in the Western media, namely the U.S. I've traveled recently to India, and actually 2 years ago, and I did an expose on the quote-unquote Shining India policy, how basically there's a huge disconnect between what middle classes are portraying to be a very successful and very bright future, and basically a majority of population of about 700 million people who are basically, as one politician talking to me characterized, roadkill, sacrificial roadkill on the shiny way to the better future. And I think it seems to be that media in the U.S. specifically, which is mostly corporate-owned, tends to very much emphasize the globalization benefits and all the aspects of the positive increase versus really emphasizing that this particular mode of development brings huge distortions to the societal structures as well as a huge amounts of conflict. And I think this is really not discussed.
Derek, thanks for the call. And Bill Emmett, a lot of issues there. But what to his point, Western media perceptions, portrayals of India and the other economies, how accurate are they?
Well, I think that they're pretty accurate. But what is correct in what your caller said is that I think the media the world over, whether corporate-owned or whoever they're owned by, tends to focus on change rather than things that are staying the same. They tend to focus on things you can take photographs of film pictures of for TV rather than things that are not changing or are looking the same. And the truth is that the changing part of India, namely the new buildings, the new roads, the new high-tech locations, are photogenic. They do represent change, but they are not typical, because what's happening in India is that too much of the economy is staying the same. In other words, India has always been poor. It's always had the bulk of people in rural areas, in agriculture, who are living in often very squalid, absolute poverty conditions. And what's the case so far is that not enough of those people are benefiting from the globalization. So we need, as media, to focus not only on the change, but also on what is not changing and what needs to change. In defense of India, I'd say it's early days. They've only just begun to shine. So we can't expect poverty to be eliminated overnight. But we as media should pay attention to whether it is indeed beginning to change.
And
how,
fortunately,
in some respect, it's left alone.
Unfortunately, we have to leave it there, Bill Emmett. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Bill Emmett has been with us from Somerset, England. He is the author of the new book, Rivals, How the Power Struggle Between China, India, and Japan Will Shape Our Next Decade. You can check out his website, by the way, at billemmett.com. Karen Prager produced this hour and also provided us with on-air production. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.